Welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a place that brings together people passionate about positive impact. In today's episode, I'll be revisiting some of the most memorable moments from series 1 and 2 of Conduit Conversations, listening back to a few of the inspiring guests who have joined me on the podcast so far. First up is Krishan Amanpour, chief international anchor of CNN and host of an award-winning global affairs program, Amanpour, on CNN International and PBS. From reporting on Saddam Hussein's trial to interviewing Colonel Gaddafi, Krishan is renowned for tackling some of the world's most consequential figures and framing global conversations, guided by her core principle, truthful, not neutral. I asked her what that mantra means in the age of fake news. I want to talk a little bit about fake news. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that you place social media in the hands of intelligence agencies and demagogues, you can weaponize disinformation. Yeah. And the weaponizing of disinformation can shift elections, alter elections, and can cause mass atrocity.
Yeah.
Let's just start with the phenomenon of fake news, mm-hmm. that this is something that's a thing. Mm-hmm. How you think about that, how you deal with it, and how we're going to root it out, because it's clearly a prevalent cancer in our midst.
So I would direct everybody, if they haven't already seen it, to the new Netflix film documentary called The Great Hack, done by the wonderful Karim Amer and Jehan Nujaim. Really a great film, and it lays out all these perils in forensic detail, and it's got more information and more interviews about how precisely many people are, you know, swerved off the beaten track of truth and swerved into the sphere of propaganda, lies, and manipulation. So I think that's a really good primer or primer, whatever you say, for people to get rooted in. And then I would say there is such a thing as fake news. It's called lies. Lies have been part of any leader or any person's strategy since time immemorial. Propaganda is another word for it. The reason it's so dramatic now is because it's, as you said, weaponized by the exponential delivery of these lies and this propaganda and this weapon on social media. And because there are far fewer gatekeepers, far less parameters. And therefore, the burden of I don't know, guarding the truth falls on, I think, a few individuals and a few companies that have a track record of being mainstream. Has become a dirty word. I don't think it's a dirty word. I think mainstream is good. It's neither on that extreme or that extreme. It's just mainstream. And we give you the facts and you can trust us. We are a brand that you know and you can trust. So whatever you see out there, whatever you see online, come and check it with us. Go on CNN.com, go on PBS, go on the New York Times, go on The Guardian, go on all these places which have proven track records, Channel 4, all the rest of it, of investigating and being able to guard the truth and project the truth. I've said several times that I do believe it is up to individuals to guard their own truthometer. Because, yeah, you can listen or watch or click on all this clickbait stuff, but it's your responsibility in the end to figure out how to use this technology. Because we've tried, we can't rein in the Facebook types. Yes, we've managed to kill off Cambridge Analytica, but who knows where they're going to pop up next. And they do have, obviously, with the great help of experts in the field, the Russians, really brilliant. I mean, my favorite story is about General Gerasimov, who's in charge of their war by other means, and their little green men who went into Ukraine, and their, no, these are not our tanks, they're somebody else's. I mean, they do it in a brilliant way, the Russians, and they have been doing it for decades. So all of that we have to guard against by going to trusted sources. How difficult can it be?
We When Joey Zwillinger co-founded Allbirds with Tim Brown, he had no idea that it would become the fastest growing shoe company in the world. Using materials including merino wool from New Zealand and eucalyptus from my home country, South Africa, Allbirds is built on a philosophy of sustainability and simplicity. With their products dubbed the world's most comfortable shoes, it's an approach that seems to be working well. So well, in fact, that in 2019, Amazon launched a shoe with a copycat design. If I have the story right, Amazon has ripped off your design and is selling a shoe for half the price that has no sustainable credentials. Is that a fair summary?
Yes.
And this is the largest retailer in the world.
Correct.
So let me just restate that. You're a shoe company that is trying to be not just carbon neutral, but ultimately carbon negative. You are 4 or 5 years old. You're valued at $1.4 billion or more, but are still this pioneering attempt to try and marry together commerce and positive social impact. And the world's largest retailer has shamelessly, and I've looked at the images, copied your shoe, sold it at half the price to undercut what you've spent years developing yourselves, and done so in a way that doesn't reflect the externalities and the harm that the fashion, apparel, footwear industry otherwise inflicts on the world.
Yeah, I think it's part of the battle here, and we're trying to do something hard, and there's obviously a lot of competing forces working to do things the way they've always been done, because those have been profitable in the past. And yeah, Amazon introduces a really interesting dynamic into this market. They have more data than anyone in the world in retail. They understand, in the U.S., it's been cited that over 50% of product searches on the internet go through Amazon's search bar. And so they get what everyone wants. They know what everyone wants because everyone's searching into the bar. So if they understand what people want, that can direct their internal efforts to make something if they see a business opportunity. And you know, knowing what I know about footwear production, there's absolutely no way you can profitably make and sell a shoe for $45 that applies the same rigorous sensitivities on the environment and animal welfare and frankly, just quality craftsmanship that we use in our production to do so at that price. And so given that impossibility, I think I don't have much concern that this is going to impact our business, to be honest. I have confidence that we have priced this at a way that allows us to make a bit of money, but not so much that people can undercut us and still deliver the quality to consumers. So in the long run, this is a bump in the road that really doesn't give our company too much pause, but certainly grab some headlines, given that, as you said, they're a pretty dominant retailer. So see how it goes.
I mean, I'm not worried about you. I'm worried about the planet, in the sense that you know, I think what this embodies is we live in a moment where entities that have enormous amounts of power have a corresponding level of responsibility imposed upon them. And if what entities which have, you know, the biggest retail footprint in the world do is look at sustainable products, copy them and undercut them in ways that don't take the embedded environmental impact in them, that's just grossly irresponsible.
Well, I think that's right. Yeah. And ironically, this product came out that you're referencing came out the same week they made their green pledge, and their green pledge was, you know, a step in the right direction. Of course, anything that companies do to green their workforce or green their impact is great. But given the scale and the scope of what they do, the irony around making that pledge that even to a lot of Amazon employees as they came out on the climate strike last week, were unhappy with and didn't think was a sufficient impact on the world, and then come out with a product that, as you said, didn't adhere to the same fundamental principles of carbon mitigation is, well, it's ironic. And so I think that is, as you say, the responsibility. And if you're the most valuable company in the world, over $1 trillion of market valuation, I think taking that responsibility and doing something positive with it is the base level expectation that people should have of a company like that.
Cristiana Figueres is an internationally recognized leader on climate change. As Executive Secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change from 2010 to 2016, her efforts culminated in the historic Paris Agreement of 2015. In person, Cristiana is dynamic, passionate, deeply knowledgeable, and single-minded when it comes to addressing the climate crisis. In our conversation, she explained why she thinks it's a mistake to suggest that saving the planet will require sacrifice.
Human beings are notoriously bad in taking steps that are necessary in the long term but painful in the short term.
I actually think human beings are notoriously good human beings. That is my point of departure. If I didn't believe that, I could not get up in the morning. But carry on.
I happen to believe that human beings are inherently good and capable of greater good than are evil.
Indeed, we agree on that one.
But I think we need to incentivize them to take steps in the short term that may feel that they're giving something up or may feel as though they're painful for long-term benefit.
Well, yes, if you think that going to the gym is obviously painful for a long-term benefit. I happen to think that addressing climate change is not a sacrifice and is not painful. I actually think that that is a myth that is really important to puncture and put to bed. Because please don't tell me that having more livable cities with better transportation, with cleaner air, with more green space, that is all about decarbonizing the economy of an urban area. Is that painful? No, actually, that is an improvement in the quality of life.
As a BAFTA-winning and Oscar-nominated actor, writer, and director, Chiwetel Ejiofor will be instantly recognizable to many from his work in films like 12 Years a Slave, Doctor Strange, and even Love Actually. What most people won't know, however, is that Chiwetel is committed to positive social change, principally through his work with the Brightland Academy, a school in southeast Nigeria founded by his mother. He joined me on Conduit Conversations to meditate on the relationship between his Hollywood profile and his work as an activist. How do you strike the balance between what is undeniably a political seam that runs through your work and what you're interested in and passionate about and your connections back to your motherland and an entire parallel universe of Hollywood and celebrity and Vanity Fair parties and the things that come with, you know, quite richly deserved, you know, fame, which has arisen from your work? How does that juxtaposition work out for you?
Well, it turns out I actually happen to spend very little time at Vanity Fair parties and in that that side of the kind of Hollywood machine. Not necessarily through choice. I just haven't. It's not something that I've, you know, dived into feet first, particularly. So I don't see a lot of that, you know, in a way. And even when I lived in Los Angeles, I wasn't as excited about that side of it all and the engagement of that. But I did recognize that it was, that, you know, making films and talking about films in this way is, look, not every film has to be, you know, centered around huge and important issues. You know, part of it is, of course, about entertaining and engaging and entertaining people and also artistic expression, you know, which I love. And so there's there's all of that. And I felt like that has actually taken up the majority of my time. And Hollywood and Los Angeles, you know, is able to facilitate a lot of those things. And of course, you know, within the context of that, you can facilitate all of these other conversations and all of this other engagement. There are enough people who are engaged with all of these things for it to matter in terms of entertainment, you know, in terms of entertainment as a sort of as an umbrella term. And so, you know, Hollywood can encompass all of those things. And I'm happy for that. You know, I'm happy for all of the celebrity parties and the kind of and all of the sort of frivolity of it, if you like. Because I think underneath a lot of that, you know, can be very serious, very dynamic engagement. And I think it allows people to find their way into those conversations, as in the general public, into those conversations and into that space in a way that isn't necessarily sort of didactic or sort of elitist in a way, which is what some of the dangers are or can be.
So part of what we try and do in the show is give particularly young people who are thinking about starting their lives and their careers and are wanting to lead lives of meaning and of purpose and of social impact advice as to the pathways they might take. And if there's a group of people out there who are interested in the performing arts and are interested in artistic expression but also want to achieve impact in the way you undoubtedly have, what's your advice to them?
Well, I think it's about finding your passion, you know, and that I think that's true artistically, but I think it's also true in terms of your social impact. I think the thing about it is that you've got to find things or think about things that you really do care about and that you really are going to be involved in forever. Essentially, and that because I think you need that kind of depth of commitment to something to really push through it. I feel that it's not, you know, for a lot of people, I think that sometimes it can be, and this is not a criticism particularly, because I think that there are different ways of coming to this whole thing. But for some people, you know, that there's an idea of becoming famous, becoming a celebrity, and then taking on a couple of projects and sort of pet projects that are part of that, and although that's fine, you know, I think it can be more direct and more engaged and more passionate if the work in a way has been done beforehand. That's just in my experience. People who before they were celebrities, before they were, you know, when they were at drama school, when they were starting out, when they were thinking about what they were going to do, maybe they weren't going to go into the arts at all, already cared about certain issues, had already isolated the things that I feel are not, that are unjust in the world that I see and why they're unjust and what the problems are and how I might be able to help in that conversation, how I might be able to engage. And those people who then go into the arts and then maybe become successful, who have already established that sort of identity, I think can be incredibly impactful.
Speaking to award-winning British-Turkish novelist Elif Shafak, it's impossible not to be struck by her intellect and her bravery. A champion of reading as the key to remaining engaged and energized as a global citizen, her latest book, 10 Minutes, 38 Seconds in This Strange World, was shortlisted for the 2019 Booker Prize. Our conversation covered identity, writing as activism, tribalism, and wounded democracies. Before we drew to a close, I asked her whether she was able to feel optimistic about the future of the world. So we always like in these conversations to try and focus on potential, on possibility, and indeed I'd like to say optimism. And so if there are real grounds to be alarmed and concerns, if inequality and climate are the dual existential threats of our time, and if the abuse of women and violence against women compounds that, tell us a little bit about reasons to hope or pathways to optimism. And perhaps it's an unfair question, and perhaps you don't want to be placed under that burden, but are there things that give you optimism?
You know, sometimes I jokingly think I can't be too optimistic because I'm Turkish. So, you know, it's not in my genes much. And I also think that if you go towards, if you open a map of Europe and if you trace the river Danube, the blue Danube with your finger, as your finger moves from Germany towards the Black Sea, I think the level of optimism drops considerably. By the time you reach Romania, Bulgaria, the Black Sea and Turkey, we're not very optimistic cultures. Understandably, we have more complex histories. But joking aside, I think it's okay to be a little bit pessimistic, but also we need a little bit of optimism as well. And they can go hand in hand, because as we've seen with the case of 2000s, extreme optimism is no good. It makes us too comfortable and sometimes even arrogant. And it gives us the illusion that actually we're good. We don't really have to fight for democracy. We don't really have to worry for democracy, because things will move forwards one way or another, because history always moves forward. That's what optimism says. And I think that's where it makes a huge mistake. History does not always go forward. Sometimes it goes backwards. Sometimes it draws circles, as we've seen in South Africa, as we've seen in Turkey. So I think a little bit pessimism is okay. But on the other hand, as you said, too much pessimism will also debilitate us, and it only creates apathy. You know, it creates a different fatigue. There was an interesting study recently that showed close to 40% of people in the UK today have said, you know what, I don't follow Brexit news anymore. I don't want to hear anything related to Brexit anymore. And they call it Brexit fatigue. But that's also dangerous, because when we are tired of hearing the news and information, and when we feel demoralized by what's happening, we become disconnected. And nothing is going to change if we are disconnected. We have to become more engaged citizens. So all I'm trying to say is, I think I like what Antonio Gramsci used to talk about, the Italian political thinker. He used to talk about the pessimism of the intellect and the optimism of the will, optimism of the heart. And I think we live in an age in which we're going to need both. The mind has to be a little bit pessimistic so that we can be more alert, more aware, but the heart has to be optimistic. And that optimism is going to come from our fellow human beings. When you talk to people, young people, minorities, women, people of all backgrounds, from all countries and nationalities, there is a very strong spirit of humanism that is still there, and that can be encouraged and emboldened. And I think that should give us hope.
Thank you so much for listening to this wrap-up episode of Conduit Conversations. Don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast platform to be the first to hear season 3 when we return in a few weeks' time. If you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to leave a rating and review so that more people can discover our guests and their extraordinary work. Please also visit theconduit.com, where you can find out more about The Conduit and our community of changemakers.